My name is Hilary Ellis, and I was born in 1924, and I've lived in this area all but 8 years of my life. And that eight years of my life I lived at Murarundi, and after I decided to leave Murarundi, I came back to West Walls End area. Previous to that, I'd lived in Harmsville. There were five children in our family, and my father, he worked in the mines. Because my mother didn't work, women didn't work in those days, you know.
Yeah.
It was just one breadwinner. And my parents, they were born and reared in Ninmai. But they come from migrant stock. My grandfather was a Welshman, and my grandfather and mother's side was English. I went to Ninmai school, and I didn't get any higher than sixth class in those days. And I left school when I was 3 months before I turned 14. The people that I went to school with, they left about 14, but the lucky ones whose parents could afford it, they went to Plattsburgh High School at Walls End. But there, most of our parents those days were on the dole, and there's only a handful of lucky persons that had parents working that could have sent them to high school. The discipline at school those days was very harsh, and when I say harsh, I mean exactly that, because you didn't hardly have to blink an eye, and the teacher would whack you anywhere with a 3-foot cane as thick as your finger. That's a fact, and he didn't draw any punches, pull any punches. I've seen boys called out to his desk, stand on the floor, and get 6 cuts across the hands, and welts come up on your fingers, on the hands as thick as your finger, and they go back to their seat and then work. That's what schools were like in those days. You want to know, can I remember anything else about your school days? Yes, I can remember that most of the kiddies that went to those schools those days, they went barefoot. They went with the backside out of their pants, and mostly no buttons on their shirts. And they were handed down clothes, handed down from one boy to another. And a lot of the boys those days, they had a very skimpy lunch hour. There was no tucker wasted in those days, because nobody could afford it. It was too hard to get. What sort of games we play at school? Well, very much the same as what you fellas play now. We played soccer. The girls played hopscotch, and they used to skip. The big game amongst the boys was marbles, hockey, and they used to have their afternoons once a week where they'd have their sports, just like you fellas do now, I take it, you know. Yeah. And they'd have races and that. And, well, it was quite a big day, you know. What entertainment was available in the area? Well, entertainment those days was very, very scarce. You had to make your own entertainment. And as far as our schoolboys was concerned, we used to spend most of our free time in the bush. We'd go bird nesting, we used to save the birds' eggs, collect them, you know, and we'd take one. If we found a bird's nest, we'd take one egg out of each nest, and we'd blow it, and we'd have in a box lined with flour in the bottom, and we'd have a collection of birds' eggs. And that's how, even today, it's never left me, the knowledge of what types of birds is in the bush around me. I can lay in bed of a morning now solely because of my early training, you know, in the bush, and I can tell my wife what birds I can hear in the bush, the names of them. And that's because we had to do things like that, make our own entertainment when we were kids, you know. And most of our parents had a cow or two. We used to make our own butter and supply our own milk. And it was generally the boys that had to milk the family cow before they went to school and when they come home from school. And that's more or less, you know, the sorts of things we had to do. Now and again, those days, there was a lot of competition amongst the villages around this area with football, and they used to have their own little soccer clubs and soccer teams, and most every little village had their football club, and about once a month they'd have a competition, you know, and have big football games there.
Places were involved in the competition?
Oh, there'd be Walls End, West Walls End, there'd be Jesmond, Waratah and Minmai, and, you know, sometimes Curry and Maitland. They'd travel down sometimes by train. Sometimes the best way they could get there, they'd either drive by sulky or come by train.
Where was it at?
Oh, they used to take it in turns around each place, you know. And of course, it's very much the same as what is now. Each football team had their own followers.
Mm.
And say if Minmai was playing at West Walls End, you'd see a lot of Minmai people walking out through the bush to West Walls End to watch the team play. That's the way it went. Now they wanted, you asked me, did we listen to the wireless? Well, in the early part of my school days, there was nobody in my town had a radio. And when one person did get it, he was working. His name was Mr. Bilby, George Bilby from Minmai, and he was a miner, and he was working during the Depression. And the radios was just in vogue, and he got one. And he lived on the hill above me, and it had a big horn on the top of it, and it was about 3 feet high by about 2.5 feet wide, and it worked by a wet battery, like a car battery, and about 3 dry cell batteries, and they were big ones. They were as big as the car battery. And you'd see, when the cricket come around, you'd see half the town up in Bilby's yard sitting around anywhere in the shade that they could find, you know, listen to the cricket matches, because nobody else had one. And after that, the crystal sets came in, and they used to run off what we called a cat's whisker, and you had to adjust the cat's whisker and get it set the proper setting before you could get a signal. And they used to work those off of earphones that they used to get from the old time telephone sets, you know.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing they used to do those. Yeah, picture theatres, yes, there was a few picture theatres around. There's one at West Walls End, and in the early days there was one in Ninmore. And it was built out of bush timber with sheet iron, sides and back, and roofing was sheet iron too. And there were two picture shows at Walls End in those days. One of them was built on the same lines as the Minmai Theatre, made out of bush poles, and the other one was a brick place. It was quite a modern place. West Walls End, it wasn't a bad old picture show, it was timber also, and it went until about 15 years ago, I think it was still going. Well, employment. Well, when I left school to start work on a dairy farm, and it was about 2 miles down the Hexham line that ran from the pit in Minmai. Big dairy farm over in the paddocks there, and I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and walk down to that dairy farm and help them milk. And I'd work there all day long. We'd be making hay, cutting char, rearing bobby calves, you know, on the bucket.
Yeah.
And I'd get home for me tea at 8 o'clock at night. And I got 10 shillings a week and my keep for that job. Now, 10 shillings is equivalent to our, today, it would be equivalent to our dollar note. So, but those days, in the Depression days, it stretched a long way, not like today with inflation. So, when I turned 16, I got a job out of Stockwick and Colliery. There was a new tunnel going in then called Freeman's Tunnel.
Yeah.
And John Freeman was the man that opened it up, and he was an old Minmai man and a friend of our family, and he gave me a job there, and I was known as a sidler then, and I used to have to drive 2 big draft horses, independently of each other, and the tunnel, she was steep, very steep, and I'd take down, back down the tunnel, 20 empty skips in one load, and the horse that I drove had a tail chain on, and when I got to the tunnel mouth and the tunnel dipped down, I'd have to run ahead and disconnect the tail chain and yell at the horse, and he was trained, he'd come out and the skips would go down past him, and I'd have to stand at the tunnel mouth with a big arm full of sprags. You know what a sprag is? Well, it's a square piece of timber about 2 inches square, and it would be 18 inches long, and I'd have an armful of those, and as the skips come past me, I'd have to time my throw and throw them into the wheels of the skips as they was going past me. And if you didn't get them all in, they'd smash up on the bottom on the, what we call the flat down the tunnel, about 3/4 of a mile down on the flat in the tunnel. And it did often happen that you did miss. And sometimes if it was raining and a wet day, even though you got your sprags in, with the mud on the lines and that, on the rails, they'd get away from you and you couldn't hold them. And I've saw myself and another young chap that was working with me, we'd be working in mud up to our knees. And the smell of it would turn you sick, you know. And we'd have 8 hours of that. And we'd get £10 a fortnight was our wages those days. And that was good money. Good money those days, because I'd take that money home and I'd give it to my mother. I'd get 5 shillings for pocket money back. And I thought I was doing all right, you know? So, and then I graduated from driving the horses, and they put a, what they called an endless rope, and it stretched right down to the inside the tunnel, and it went right across the big valley from pit top, and it would be at least 1.5 miles from the pit top down to where the railway screens were, you know, the, where they took the coal, they emptied it in the bins, and the railways trucks would pick them up. And that rope never stopped, it kept going, and it would, one side, it had 2 sets of skip lines, and one side, the rope brought the empty skips up and took them back down the mine, and the other side brought the full skips up, full of, loaded with coal, and it'd be about, a ton and a half on each skip. And us young fellas, we were what was known, we used to look after that endless rope. We were known as the clippers, and we used to have these big steel clips that clipped onto the rope and clipped onto the skip, and we used to have an iron bar 1/2 inch thick and about 14 inches long, and it had a screw on top of the clip. And we used to have to put that clip on while the rope was still going, and then put the iron bar through a ring on the screw on top of the clip. And we used to have to screw that up tight. And that's what held that. There used to be about 6 full skips go down to the screens, and that would be going continuously all day. You'd stop for lunch only, you know, and we'd have to work till 3:30. And that's the sort of work we were doing those days. And there was no machinery in the early part of my work in the mines. The miners themselves, they used to have to go down with the they'd have their tin of powder with gelignite in, you know, sticks of gelignite in these big tin tins they were, and they'd have detonators in another tin, and they'd have their drills. Now the drills was in different lengths. The first drill might be 18 inches, and then the next one would be 3 feet, right up to about 6 to 7 feet. And they'd go down to the mine face, you know, to the face, and they'd drill holes certain places on the mine face, and they'd go right in, and they'd have a wooden stick a long wooden stick, a round one, and they'd ram the dynamite up into the end of those holes, and they'd already, the last stick of gelignite that went in, they had a wooden stick sharpened like a meat skewer. You've seen a corn, like a rolled roast with the skewers in it. Well, that's what the wooden skewers was like that they used, and they'd drive that into the end of the dynamite, and they'd stick these electric detonators into those, and then they'd tamp clay in over the top of that again to stop it coming back out, and then they'd go around the corner and they'd set it off electrically with a little battery, and then blow the place down. When that blew, if you were up what we call the gob, further around the tunnel a bit, you know, those days we used carbide lights. They worked with carbide is it's like a lot of soft stones, and you used to have to, you'd have this little light with a screwed bottom, and you fill the bottom up full of carbide, and it had a water tank on the top, and it was made so that you pull the lever and the water would come down into the mix with the carbide, a drop at a time, and the gas would come out, and come out a little hole at the top, and you'd light that there, and it would throw a flame out about 4 to 5 inches, and that's what we worked by. And many a time when they fired a shot and you were up the tunnel, the concussion would drive all the air back from where the explosion was, and she'd blow your lamp out and you'd be in pitch dark. And I don't know if you've ever seen what darkness is. It's not just like closing your eyes. When you get down there and your light goes out, it's dark. And you can't see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah.
You've got to do everything by feel. And that was another thing about the carbide lights. If you were working on your own and your light went out, you had to fill it with carbide. You had to refill it with water and find your matches. Sometimes they were equipped with a flint, like a cigarette lighter, but they were modern ones. But mostly you had to use matches. So you always had to make sure that you knew, even in the dark, where you left your supply of carbide and your water bottle, so that you could find it. So, horses. There was a chap the name of Reg O'Donnell. He lives in Harmsville today. We were the same age, and we had a job of bringing the horses, the pit horses, up from Stockton, old Stockton I'm talking about, not new Stockton like Freeman's Tunnel. It was about 2 miles from old Stockton, but in the beginning they had the horse stables up at the old Stockton. And we had to call in there on our way to work in the morning and pick about 35 horses up and drive them back up to the tunnel mouth, to Freeman's Tunnel, to get the work done for the day. And we'd ride two of them up, and being boys, we used to have a bit of shy-acking around, racing one another and that. You know, but that was a big part of the day, was getting those horses up and taking them back of a night. But the horses, they were like us. They knew their job. They knew when we got them out the stable where they were going, and away they went. And the same at the night time, they even wanted to get home faster than we did, because they were They were hungry and tired,
yeah.
and they knew what was waiting for them. See, they had, had the stables waiting for them there, and they got looked after like babies. So, but things has changed now, you know. They've got all the modern machinery in, and personally, I haven't been in the mines now for 25, 28 years, and the machinery in now, I suppose, would even surprise me. But those days, we used to be able to listen to the roof talking to us. We knew when it was time to get out of the tunnel. We used to listen to the working of it, you know, and we knew. But the cracking of the props and things like that, that she was going to come down in a certain place, and we'd go. But that's why in modern times as today, you hear of these mine accidents, and the miners get taken by surprise because they can't hear the roof talking to them for the noise of the machinery they're using. And that's what's killed many of the present-day miners. It killed a lot in the old days too, but not like it does today, because they had what they call mind sense.
It was like an instinct.
Yes. Yes. I saw miners underground working, and they were dressed in all sorts of old clothes and that. And there was one chap, he used to work at the face, and he had his mate with him, and his name was Hetherington. And the chap I'm talking about, the chap the name of Frank Condry, he's dead now, he's passed on. And his son worked too in the mine where he worked. But old Frank, he used to work with a cloth cap on and his carbide light on top of that cap. And he had his pit boots on and a pit belt. And he'd have a scrap of cloth down over the front of him, nothing on behind, his backside was all bare. And it was a sight to sore eyes if you come into the working place and Frank was down with a shovel shoveling the coal up.
Yeah.
You can imagine what it was like. But that was the conditions. That man couldn't work any other way because he couldn't stand clothes on him the way the heat would get, you know.
Mm.
If the air was a bit off, which it generally was in the mines those days, they used to depend a lot on the on the air tunnels and the brattas, the way they had the brattas up in the mines and that, to draw the air down. In the early days, they used to use fire. They used to light a fire in a shaft, you know, the bottom of the shaft,
mm-hmm.
and use that to draw the air through the mines. Mm. So,
it's very interesting.
Mm. Mm.
Would you mind moving on to the next question, please?
Yes. Went a bit too long on that one, didn't
it? Oh, it's very good anyway.
Now, how did people travel when we were young? Well, mostly we travelled by horse and sulky, or horse and cart, or horseback. There was an odd car around, but you fellas wouldn't get in the cars that was around those days. Today you fellas wouldn't ride in because they were flat out at about 25 to 30 miles an hour. They were flat out those days. But another thing you've got to take into consideration was the condition of the roads. The roads those days were made for horse and carts, you know?
Yeah.
So, In the later part of me young days, there was, when things started to pick up a little bit after the depression, the big depression, there was a few more cars come out and they started to improve. But mostly it was Shanks's pony, which is walking or horseback, and that was the common thing. I recall in the early part of it, when the trams used to run from Wall's End to Newcastle and the Newcastle districts, you know, Waratah and those places.
Through Jesmond.
Yeah. And they used to move along, they were electric trams, and they were a good service, much superior to what we've got today. They're far better than the buses.
Yeah.
There was nothing. Those days, if there was big crowds at the football or people at the beaches, they used to go to the beach a lot there in Newcastle those days, and they used to come from here and from Minmai and Wall's End, and there was hundreds of people, and I've never seen anything to shift a crowd like those trams used to. Yes, they're not like the buses. The buses today can't compare them. And it was a big mistake when they did away with the Newcastle and Wall's End trams. It was the biggest mistake they've ever made.
Yeah.
But years ago, I can't remember, but this is before my time, in West Wall's End they used to have the steam tram.
Yeah.
And it used to run right from down past the golf links, right through Edgeworth, it was known as Young Wall's End those days, and through the bush to Wall's End. And those steam trams, I remember my parents, they used to ride in on that, and they tell me that they were very unstable, and there was quite a few bad accidents those days in the steam trams, but they done the job. And they went out when the electric trams came in. Did people go to Newcastle very often? Yes, they went in there about once a fortnight, you know, and Newcastle was a day out, and those days, to supplement the family income from the dole, when the blackberry season come in, this is in Minmai where I was living at the time, we used to have to go out and we'd pick a couple of kerosene tins of blackberries, and we'd drive them to Wall's End in the horse and sulky with the blackberries. The next day we used to do this, and we'd catch a tram into Newcastle and we'd walk the streets and we'd sell those blackberries, and we used to sell them for a couple of pence a cup, and it was hard work because in the summertime when the berries was in, we used to have to go out and we'd put up with the mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes would carry you away then days, because all the Hexham swamps was bare and they didn't have any of those mosquito fish in that we've got in today, and they spray the swamps on that now, but they didn't those days. And we'd have a rolled up piece of Hessian bag in one hand, and we'd have a billy can hanging on our stomach from a rope around our neck, and we'd be picking with one hand and holding this rolled up hessian, and we'd have that on fire at one end, and it was smoking, that was to keep the mosquitoes off us. And you try picking a kerosene tin and blackberries and see how long it takes you. And by the time we'd get one kerosene tin picked and have to do another one, the sun would be up and it'd be stinking hot. And by the time we got home, we'd had enough, you know. But that was the sort of things you have to do those days. Or we'd go out and we'd shoot rabbits. And Mr. Lambert could tell you. He was one of the old school rabbiters, you know.
Yeah.
And he'd done his share of shooting. He'd have to go and shoot for the pot. And we'd shoot redbills and waterfowl, ducks and rabbits. And we had no choice. We either that or go hungry. And that's the way we had to live. And during the Depression those days, about once every couple of months, the government used to put out, they used to send my mother and father and other kids' mother and fathers too, dole tickets. And you'd go up to the local community hall and they'd hand you out discarded army clothes and shoes, and you'd have army, you'd see everybody around the town that wasn't working going around in a pair of khaki army pants and an old army short coat, and in the winter time an army great coat, you know. Yeah. Khaki shirts and these great big strong boots, you know, all discarded from the army. And you couldn't go, like, they didn't give, like they do now, that you can get your dole, you can go and draw your dole. And they give it to you in cash. Those days they didn't. They used to give you a dole ticket. And they'd tell you what shop you had to go and spend it in. And you could only get the amount's worth of was on that ticket. It was stipulated on that ticket. You could only buy that. And if you used that up before you got your next dole allotment,
yeah,
you were hungry. And that's how come that most of the people those days were shooters. You know, they used to have to go out and supplement by fishing and shooting and things like that. So You sit there when you get time, try to visualise it. Yeah. See how you'd like it now. We weren't bored. You hear young people today, I've heard it with my own kiddies, saying, oh, I've got nothing to do, I'm bored. And I say to them that boredom is only in your own mind. It's an insult to your own intelligence. We were never bored. We didn't have time to be bored. And you've got to entertain yourself. And that's where the young people today differ from our time. I'm not trying to hurt your feelings by any means. I'm just saying the young people today don't know what it is to entertain themselves. They've got to be entertained. And that's the difference between your generation and mine. Right, now, what are we up to now? The cooking. Right, now I told you what we shot. Well, that's what we cooked. But today we use a lot of vegetable oils because we're taught that fat is no good for you. Like animal fats and stuff like that, it's no good for you because it's got cholesterol in it. So we use vegetable oils and substitutes now, something that's got no cholesterol in it or anything like that that'll harm you. But those days we didn't know it, and that was another thing. We used to fry a bit of bread in dripping and put a bit of salt and pepper on it, and that's what we ate, you know, when we were hungry. And I've seen boys, I've taken it myself to school on our lunch, a bit of dripping instead, you know, on our sandwiches, and that was our sandwiches. So that's the sort of thing we ate, besides what we shot and killed, you know. Yes, we had home remedies those days, and a lot of the old home remedies were a darn sight better than what the doctors try to give you now. My mother's favourite remedy, now if we had a cold we couldn't get rid of, and inflammation of the chest or anything like that, she'd bung you into bed. And not only my mother, but most of the rest of the fellas' mothers, and they'd put a mustard poultice on your chest out of flannel cloth, and it'd be a hot mustard poultice. And if the mustard itself didn't take the skin off you, the heat of it when they put it on. And if you squealed and let on, you got a smack across the ear. But it cured you. So that was one of the remedies, you know. But they were great believers then. No matter what you had wrong with you, and you went and complained to your mother that you didn't feel well, they'd get hold of your nose and they'd put a tablespoonful of castor oil down your throat.
Castor oil?
Castor oil. And I've seen me bring it up. As quick as Mum poured it down, I'd bring it up. And I'd got a hiding for that. It was terrible stuff. You try it sometime to find out. Well, I told you what the roads were like. When I was single, my family never got a car. They didn't have a car. Later on, just after I got married, I got myself a little car, and I taught myself to drive it. Nobody gave me any lessons. Nobody else around the place knew how to drive. And I lived up in Elizabeth Street in Harnsville at the time, and the car I got was a little Triumph, a 1930 model Triumph, 7 horsepower. And it only had one door, and that was on the passenger side. The driver's side didn't have a door. You had to get in the passenger side, and it had a pointed, only had 2 seats, and a pointed back, you know?
Yeah.
And a rag hood. Touring hood.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, it had hydraulic brakes. It had hydraulic brakes on it, and it used to be quite fast. Believe it or not, but it was quite fast. And we were, we found it hard to get hydraulic fluid to put in the brakes, so I used to make my own hydraulic fluid up, and I used to make it out of methylated spirits and castor oil. So if you just get stuck with your own car, even the day you could use that as a substitute because there's no water in it. So yes, that was my first car. You want to know, you would always have a refrigerator. No, we didn't. When I was a kiddie, we didn't know what a refrigerator was, even when I was at the age that you fellas are now. What we used to have in Minmai, what my father had, we had 2 underground wells, and that was our water supply. These wells were dug into the ground, and they were lined with stones, and they had a wooden top, and the runoff from the house was piped into it. And in the summertime, if my mother wanted to make a jelly or junket, which they used to make the junket from the cow milk, and our butter, which we made from the cows ourselves, but Mum used to put it in buckets and tie a rope to the bucket and put the buckets down into the water so that they're half submerged in the water. And she'd leave that in there all day and night and go and get it out when we wanted to use it. And that's how we used to keep our things in them. And then later on, my father, he got a 2-foot earthenware pipe. It was about 3 foot long and it had a lip on the top where they used to join the pipes together. And he sunk that into the ground and he concreted the floor in it. And he used to have a wooden lid for the top of it and a corn bag over the top of that wooden lid, and he used to have that wet all the time, and that kept things very cool, very much like the refrigerators today at about that temperature, you know, really at a comfortable coolness.
Yeah.
They were good. Later on we used to come out, they came out with the ice chests, and those ice chests, they were lined with charcoal, made of wood. And they were lined with charcoal, and they used to open the top of them. They had a door on the front and another door on the top, and they used to put a big block of ice down in that, and they were quite efficient, really good. So that was the types of things we had to do those days for cooling purposes. Well, I've told you how people mine the coal. I mentioned a few of them. There was a mine in Ninmai, in fact there was a couple of mines in Ninmai. The biggest mine in Ninmai when I was a child, it was closed, but it was still there. Everything was still there, the big pit top and everything. It was standing as they'd left it, walked out and left it. And in recent years, they've pulled it all down, and there's another big mine on the site, and it's working today in there. So, and there was the big mines in Wall's End, and there was mines out here in Killingworth. So, there was no shortage of coal mines around this area those days. The Rothbury mine, the lockout, I can't recall that happened before I started to take notice of these things, but I have often heard my parents talking about it. It was before my time. Remember the co-op store? I remember when it was in its heyday up here. And I met my wife there. She used to work at the co-op store. And she lived in Estoril. Well, the Westie store was a good thing because towards the end of the Depression and that, people could pay their bills fortnightly, and they used to have store tokens, what they're like coins that they used to dish out for bread, and you used to pay your bread by these tokens. You go and buy so much worth of tokens and pay your bread that way. But you could get anything you wanted there, and when it was working at its peak, it was really a good thing. But the fact of the matter was that it got that way, that it couldn't compete with modern techniques, and the modern stores and that could outsell them and underbuy them and that, and they couldn't compete with prices and that. And management went down the drain a little bit, you know. That's how it had to close down. In this district here, there was never a great lot of shopping. In my time, there was never a great lot of shops to choose from. there was in Minmai when I was young, there was a blacksmith shop. There was two general stores that I can remember. There was five hotels when I was a young fellow in Minmai. There's only one standing today. Quite a few churches. There was a Catholic church, which isn't there any longer. A Methodist church. I was christened in that church, and it was a convict built stone church. Well, it's been pulled down. The old English church, it's also a convict type built church. Well, it's still standing in Minmai, and it's the only church that's there now. But West Wall's End itself, it still retains most of the churches it had when I was a young fella. Did know a few fellas that was in the Great War, mostly my relatives. I had an uncle that went all through the Great War. I had a few family friends on my father's side that got killed in the war, and some come back in a bad way in that, but it's a little bit before my time. Told you what it was like in the life was like during World War II. Well, I can remember that certainly. And at the time, I was working in the mines, and I can remember of a night time, you'd come out around here, and you'd look out and you'd see the whole sky of a night penciled with searchlights, and you wouldn't credit how high those searchlights would penetrate up into the clouds, and they'd be going nearly, they would be going nearly all night every night those days for 4 or 5 years, and things were hard to come by. Petrol, for one thing, we were rationing petrol, and had to be very careful how we used it. Food, well, actually, we were rationed with food, but I don't think anybody went hungry. We did all right for tucker. Clothing was a little bit hard to get. We had clothing coupons, and we got by, but it wasn't easy. But those times, everybody pulled together, and you didn't hear anybody whinging and moaning. We wanted to win the war, you know, and we had to back our boys up. Nobody cried or went on about it. But I had a lot of the fellas I went to school with. Well, they never returned. There was a few of the Lord brothers from Minmai, a chap the name of David Cramp. One or two of the Waterses from Minmai. Oh, a few others, if I had time to think about them, that went to the war, never came back. But most families were affected. That's the way it went.